Parliament Funkadelic is the longest-running popular music band of all time. It is considered a pillar of rock music and to many, the very foundation of the funk genre. Some of the world's greatest musical minds can claim its fold, whether it's George Clinton, Bootsy Collins, or Bernie Worrell. The Mothership Connection has served as a superhighway of talent, and today we talk with the longest tenured keyboardist in the band's history, who is also a writer featured in the lineup for this year's Word of South Festival. Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of The Warehouse. I'm your host, Josh Johnson, and like always, we are joined with an incredibly special guest. Today's guest puts a little icing on the cake. We are joined with Danny Bedrosian, the keyboardist of our Parliament Funkadelic and the longest tenured keyboardist, if I'm not mistaken, in the band's 71-year history, right, Danny?
That's right. That's right, Josh.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us, brother.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's really exciting. This is my first time. I've lived in Tallahassee for over 20 years. Huh? This is my first time at WFSU, so I'm super excited.
I just can't believe that, but that's so cool, and I'm glad I get to christen you into the studio.
Thank you.
And so let's talk about... Let's just jump right into this conversation. Parliament Funkadelic means so much to the world and to the nation, but specifically this area. And you being one of the most decorated lieutenants in the Army of Funk joining us, I want to ask you at first a peripheral question. And that is, how did you get involved in music? And I know that your parents were concert pianists.
Yeah.
But most people rebel from their upbringing. It
right.
seems like you leaned into it. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, you know, not at first. You know, I mean, my sisters and I were all enrolled into the Bedrosian Piano School, which was in our house. So we had hundreds of kids and their parents coming in and out of our house all week long. My parents worked crazy hours all day, all night, teaching piano lessons to kids and adults of all ages. And we also were enrolled. I started at age 4, classically trained. My parents get mad when I say strict, but it was pretty strict. You know, we had to practice a certain amount of time a day. We had lessons and competitions and recitals. And so because it was the family business, as it were, I was more interested in other things. I was interested in, at a very young age, paleontology. Mm. I was interested in comic books. For years, I thought I was going to be a comic book artist. I was interested in acting. I wanted to be an actor. And I didn't really get bit by the I'm going to be a professional musician bug until I was introduced to P-Funk music around age 11 or 12. And so that was when, and as soon as I discovered it, it combined all the things that I loved in the various genres of music. Because by that time, I was already playing out in clubs, this underage kid playing in the local clubs in New England, in rock bands and hip-hop groups, metal bands and punk bands and world groups and all kinds of things. And P-Funk, to me, married it all. Jazz, gospel, everything.
Let me ask you this. I've heard you talk about your parents' record collection.
Yes.
And as a vinyl collector myself, was it your parents' vinyl collection that
yes.
introduced you to P-Funk?
No.
Was it the... How did you get that introduction?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So, I mean, my father had an amazing classical and some jazz and soul.
I see.
And my father is the one who introduced me to Ray Charles, James Brown, mm-hmm. Miles Davis. My mother was like Beatles, the Neville brothers, Aaron Neville,
sure.
the Marleys, that kind of stuff. But P-Funk I found out about through sampling. But I probably wouldn't have known about P-Funk had I not first been exposed to James Brown via my father. And he even took me to my first James Brown concert in Lowell, Massachusetts at the Lowell Auditorium in like 1989.
Uh-huh.
I was 8 years old, and it changed my entire life.
Let me ask you something. That's just too close of a scenario to something that I have. You know, I was raised on popular black music, soul and R&B and Motown, that whole thing.
Yeah.
But it was actually later in my life, like 18, 17, that I was introduced in depth to two artists that you just named, James Brown and Ray Charles.
Yeah.
It was actually my high school debate coach who introduced me to those singers. And so let me ask you, those artists. And so let me ask you something. How important do you think the inundation of art is to a person as they're younger?
Oh, Goodness. I mean, well, I think it's kind of almost involuntary, you know, like it happens to you when you don't know that it's happening to you. And it's also the sort of exposure of all of the mediums of the arts, you know, because without knowing it, I had fine arts at my disposal. My grandfather was a fine artist. My oldest sister went on to become a professional fine artist. And then obviously the classical music, jazz, I played in the church. All of these things were just second nature. They were just a part of my regular life. I remember riding to and from the choir practices with my father, and we would listen to the bebop station. It was every Wednesday or Thursday night. This one station played nothing but like Charlie Parker and Bud Powell. And it just changed the way I thought about art. And I was already aware of this as art. But yeah, how important is it? You know, a million times more important than we probably think.
You know, you brought up, I want to do a little bit of wordplay here. You brought up the fine arts. You were trained in the fine arts, but you turned into a mighty fine artist.
Thank you.
So let me ask you this, before we get to some of the stuff that has just made you a pillar in this community, in this state, in this nation, and in this world, you have had the opportunity to perform or to work with, whether directly, peripherally, however, with some of the world's greatest artists. Bo Diddley, Drake, the Chili Peppers, which are just one of my favorite, System of a Down, Kendrick Lamar, and you know, from modernity to antiquity, you've played with all of them. How does it feel, just as a personal note, how does it feel to have arrived at your dream?
Yeah, it's. I mean, a lot of that stuff is kind of still seems surreal to me, you know? But it's funny because probably the most surreal to this day is that I am, you know, a part of the core of what was my favorite band. And everything else that came mostly came as a result of being a part of that important core group of guys in what was my always my favorite band since I was a little kid, Parliament Funkadelic. And so because the group is so admired and beloved and influenced so many great artists of so many different generations, that kind of brought... It's weird. It brought them to the group that I'm in. I don't want to say it brought them to me, but it brought them to the group that I work for and brought them to George, where they come to George in the same way that I did. Like, oh, I'm not worthy. I'm not worthy, you know. And it's funny watching all these people that we consider just these pillars of music, of culture, you know, and how they look to George the same way that I always
did. The pillars look to the columns.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Right. You know, the foundation, you know.
Before we get into, because I've been salivating to ask you about Parliament Funkadelic, but before we get into that, as a fan, because I get to be a fan on this show a lot, and one of the people that I left out of that list that I left out intentionally was just because they have moved me personally in a way that I couldn't even quantify in a 30-minute set. And so we'll just do it in a 30-minute answer from you. What on earth was it like to work with Sly Stone?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. You know, Sly was really an enigma in a lot of ways. Enigmatic character, you know, genius.
Sure.
Just automatically resonates. I was actually in the band in a time that he was also in P-Funk. So he had a couple of small tenures in Parliament Funkadelic. He had one way before when I was just a baby and a toddler in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And then his second big tenure was around, I want to say 07, 08, 09. And so I had already been in the group for several years at that point. And he was like a featured part of the group where he would come with us even overseas and he would do a small piece of the set, almost a set within the set. Sometimes he would go to the keyboard with a talk box and just do some completely off the top thing in the middle of the set that nobody knew what it was going to be. And we'd all be like trying to get in where we fit in, but like having so much trouble because he is singular. He's a singular entity. And then sometimes he would surprise all of us. I remember my favorite Sly Stone story is we were playing the African Festival in Chicago, maybe 07.
Okay.
And he came out front with his guitar And he looked like he stepped right out of 1967, like he had never, like everything that had happened since then didn't happen. And he decided to time warp to us on this one day. And he never did this before or since with us. And we did like, Want to Take You Higher, Dance to the Music, sure. Everyday People, you know, a whole bunch, all of the sort of well-known, you know, Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself Again.
If You Want Me to Stay is my favorite.
Oh, right. It's a classic,
absolutely.
You know. And he went up front, like the front man that he was, you know. I was also super proud to have recorded with him on the Funkadelic, the 2014 Funkadelic album, First You Gotta Shake the Gate. There's a song on there called Yellow Light. Yeah, and that's just me and Sly, which is really cool. We're both playing keyboards and synthesizers, and he sang on it. And I mean, all the way up to the very end, he was doing things that, much like George, they're these singular entities. They never repeat themselves.
Sure.
You know? And so if you're expecting to get this guy from this time, that's not what it's supposed to be. It's not about nostalgia. It's about constantly paving the way forward. So
I heard that.
Yeah, he was a master of that.
So one of the reasons that we've brought you on today, one of the anchors of this set is going to be your participation in one of our just local cultural juggernaut events, which is Word of South.
Yes.
And what will spool out of that is your artistry in all forms, your music, your writing. And before we get into the music, I want to meld a question about your writing in Parliament Funkadelic. I don't want to ask you the same old questions you've been asked, you know, over the past 20 years. Let me read a passage from your book, and then let me ask you something.
Sure.
You say, although the P-Funk genre is arguably both thematically and lyrically transcended, moving beyond decades and eras, this book asserts just that concept, that this band also had a solid footing in the time that they were recording these seminal works. Clinton and the band found that the world around them contained a valuable treasure trove of socio-political material for the band to use in their creative process.
Mm.
The question that I have for you is two-pronged. One of them is George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic in all of the beautiful work that has spooled out of that catalog. One of the things that I think is most cheated about that legacy is people do not give them the type of social commentary credit that they deserve. Talk to me a little bit about how P-Funk actually not only spoke on issues, but helped transform some of these things.
Yeah, that's a great question, Josh. Great question. So not only being present for things like the riots at the end of the 60s and having to travel from Detroit to Newark amidst those very riots, being pulled over by the police and having to do their routine for the police who didn't believe that they were actually a singing group back in the days of them being the Parliaments, all the way to fast forward a few years into the psychedelic era and beyond, where George is creating albums like America Eats Its Young, you know, a sort of political scope that is what all too relevant today in things that are happening now.
Absolutely.
And albums like Cosmic Slop that, you know, upon first glance seem like some kind of crazoid imagery, but really deal with things like the sacrifices that the very bottom of society, mothers, had to make to raise their kids.
Sure.
That's what these topics are about. That's what this music is about.
It's about.
And there was a lot of stuff that was self-referential, self-fueling, to make the band feel as powerful as they truly were.
Mm-hmm.
But within that and sort of pushing out of that, there was all of this messaging.
Absolutely.
Which wasn't like overtly political, but it was socio-political in nature that it dealt with the world around them at large.
Absolutely.
And touched on what was happening on the ground, you know.
At the end of, and I know this is a little later, but at the end of his maggot brain speech, what does he say? Free your mind?
Oh, yeah.
Free your mind, and you know we know what comes after
right.
that.
Right, the kingdom of heaven is within. Right.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
He was always that. And so now bringing this back to you, do you believe that art has a responsibility, or do you believe that art should just exist As it spools out of the creative process.
I think art does have a responsibility. I'm a proud Armenian American and also a descendant of genocide survivors. Sure. And at the very beginning of the Armenian genocide, which was actually on April 24th, 1915, my grandfather and two of my great-great-aunts were in the genocide. So I was raised by people who were survivors. The very first day that it occurred, what they did to cut off the head of the people was they rounded up all of the artists, the artisans, the musicians, the architects, the painters, the actors, the speakers, the priests, the singers. These were the pillars of the community, so to speak. If you cut off the head of the snake, it was very easy to rid themselves of the masses of poor, mostly illiterate, farmers and people living this kind of unfree life. Their entire culture was cut off in one day, and therefore everybody else was controllable. Mm. And the government was able to do whatever they wanted to those people, to that affected minority. So the artists have not just an important role, but in my opinion, an extremely important responsibility to those who don't have the voice.
Absolutely.
So, you know, and I'm not saying that I have some kind of huge voice that can go very far, but however far it can go, that is an important responsibility that I set for our people and for the community at large, all people that listen to me or pay attention.
Another one of your peers who's an artist and writer, Toni Morrison, that answer was kind of Toni Morrison-esque, you know, in times like these are just the times that that artists should go to work. And exactly. So I hear exactly what you're saying. And so now let's just bring your talents into the scope of what we're here to talk about. You know, Word of South is a brilliant event, part and parcel because it brings brilliant talent like yourself to everyday residents and travelers of Leon County to just see up close and talk to and absorb their work. You're a writer and you're a musician, and you're so much more, but I mean, you're two main ones that we're talking about today. Does that cross-pollination help you? Do they inform each other? Do they hurt each other? Do you have to separate from both crafts to do one good? How does it feel juggling both of these art mediums at the same time?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I mean, Word of South is, in my opinion, the best thing we have artistically in Tallahassee. Uh-huh. I am so proud to be involved for my third year in a row. The first 10 years that the festival existed, I was on the road so heavily, you know, pre-COVID, we were on the road 280 to 320 days a year. Mm-hmm. So I didn't even know it existed. And I had spent the first 15 or so years clamoring in Tallahassee, you know, coming from up north, clamoring for a greater representation of the arts, a greater representation for musicians, firstly, being a musician first, but for the arts in general. And to see this thing that had been bubbling up really behind my back, not even knowing about it, and for it to come to the forefront, it's just, I'm so proud of what Mark Mustian and all the guys involved in all the great guys and ladies involved in Word of South are doing. And it is the marriage of music and the literary arts. Mm. So for someone like me who is a musician and writes about the band I'm in and other things, it is a fabulous opportunity to represent the various sort of echelons of what I do. So to answer your question, it's not necessarily hard to distinguish between or even melt those two things together for someone like me. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is because, and I was just having a conversation with a musician last night on the phone, a good friend of mine in New York City, about how there is, you know, no way in today's environment, today's sort of socio-political environment, for any single person to be like, yeah, I'm a drummer, I'm a pianist. Like, no, you have to be 100 things to be successful in this artistic world, in America at least. Now, in a lot of other countries, there are grant fellowships and all kinds of things that are put into place to help even the lowliest of aspiring, starting, naive, beginner artists to get off the ground with their craft and become great. But in America, that doesn't really exist in the way that maybe it should. So things like Word of South, these are super important marriages of mediums. And, you know, my friend group, my social clique of friends internationally, It's stand-up comics, it's actors, it's painters, it's comic book artists, it's poets, it's authors, and yes, it's musicians. But we don't really distinguish. We have big dinners and all hang out together.
All free people.
Free, and talk about what it is that's important that we're doing now. How does it sort of mix with what they're doing, what this guy and what this lady are doing? And Word of South is a great instrument, a great vessel for that sort of exploration. The concert later that day, that same day, with none other than George Clinton and several of my great bandmates, Lige Curry on the bass and Benzel Cowan on the drums. We're doing a curated set of specific P-Funk songs from 1975 to promote the last book I put out, Make My Funk the P-Funk, which is published by Bloomsbury Publishing, which is all about P-Funk's sort of paradigm shift in the year 1975, how they went from station wagons to a spaceship, essentially. And and so it's this great place where we can explore these marriages of disciplines. And you can't really do that at a regular music festival or at a regular book fair, but you can do it at Word of South.
So. Danny, in closing, I want to say something to you. When I hear your last name, Bedrosian, it kind of sounds like a derivative of bedrock, the foundation of something. And you have really been the foundation of so much artistic value in this community, in this state, and in this world. And we appreciate you.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And I appreciate you all at home for joining us for another episode of The Warehouse. See you next time. Bye-bye.